Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 429, The Triumph of the Shill, being recorded on October 13th of 2003. We're going to continue with an analysis of the recent recall election in California and how Arnold Schwarzenegger, marketed as a man of the people and every man, basically was not only put into the position he was put into, or into which he was put, but how the perversion of political reality was affected, specifically how someone who is a shill for some very powerful and cynical interests was portrayed as an everyman, a man of the people, a little man who made it big. LA Times, Saturday, October 4th of 2003, has the following article by Kim Murphy. It's headlined, Russians Wonder Who's Spinning Whom in Film. This is about the team of California strategists who were used to reshape and market Boris Yeltsin in his 1996 campaign in Russia. It reads in part, Alexander Olson remembers the day the Americans came to save Boris Yeltsin's presidential campaign in 1996. Skipping down. That spring, three former staffers for then-California Governor Pete Wilson slipped into a hotel room near the Kremlin and got to work teaching Russia, a nation with an 800-year history of coups, poisonings disguised as heart attacks, and exile to Siberia, but almost no experience in free elections, how to run a modern campaign. Enter George Gorton, Joe Shumate, and Dick Dresner. You may have heard of them not because they helped keep Yeltsin in office and preserve democracy in Russia, which they quite possibly did, but because in recent months, all three have been working overtime to put Arnold Schwarzenegger in the California governor's office. So again, the team spinning Yeltsin is the team helping to effect the triumph of the shill here in California. Note that they were aides to Governor Pete Wilson in 96. Wilson was Schwarzenegger's campaign manager. It was Wilson's energy legislation that helped to destabilize Gray Davis, and Schwarzenegger was basically hobnobbing with Enron and the other Bush-related lords of electricity, as Greg Palast put it, to basically put himself in a position to thwart the $9 billion suit that has been filed by California, and specifically by Lieutenant Governor Cruz Bustamante. There has been a fair amount of invective on some of the right-wing talk shows that has been directed against vehicles like the LA Times and others for basically reporting the news on Arnold Schwarzenegger, specifically the allegations of sexual harassment, and also something we're going to talk about later, some of Schwarzenegger's professed admiration for Adolf Hitler, something that we dealt with at considerable length in FTR's 421 and 422. Many times in the past, and in many of the programs that I have recorded on German corporate control of the American media, I've referenced the Nazi tract Serpent's Walk, published by the National Vanguard publishing arm of the National Alliance, arguably the most important domestic American Nazi group. One of the things that is key to the underground Reich's takeover of the United States in the mid-21st century is buying into and controlling the opinion-forming media, unquote. One of the things we're going to talk about here is how the tabloids laid off Arnold Schwarzenegger. In other words, they did not dish dirt on Arnold Schwarzenegger as they had many other people. And the fact that the epicenter of the tabloids, American media, was very closely linked to the business empire of Joe Weider, Arnold Schwarzenegger's patron and business partner. This was first broken in the San Jose Mercury News and then updated by the LA Times. This is from the LA Times of October 2nd of 2003. It's by Anne Louise Bardach, B-A-R-D-A-C-H. And it's headlined, it's a tab tale, Arnie Vanishes. And it reads in part as follows, skipping down. Last week, the San Jose Mercury News turned over a few pieces of the puzzle when it reported that in January, Schwarzenegger's mentor and early business partner, Joe Weider, had sold his publishing empire, including Muscle and Fitness, Shape, and Men's Fitness magazines, for $350 million to American Media, the tabloid conglomerate that owns The Inquirer, The Star, The Globe, and The News of the World. The story also disclosed that although American media's tabloids had been virtually Arnold-free since the recall race began, they just published a 120-page glossy one-off titled Arnold, The American Dream, without identifying it as one of their publications. It's on newsstands for $4.95, and one cover line reads, Camelot's Future. To complete the coronation, the News of the World ran an exclusive, Alien backs Arnold for governor. On another, it doesn't say, by the way, presumably that's a space alien. It doesn't mention whether that's perhaps an operator of the Underground Reich from Germany or Austria. Continuing, on another front, the New York Daily News reported that American media owner and CEO David Pecker had assured Weider that the tabloids were going to lay off Schwarzenegger. We're not going to pull up any dirt on him, Weider said Pecker told him. American media spokesman Richard Valvo calls the conversation unfounded rumor, unquote. Weider reconfirmed it Wednesday. One of the things to note is that the ways of business, and in fact, the old expression, money is the root of all evil, money is pretty much the root of everything, unfortunately, in a practical sense. And one of the major imperators of human behavior is money. And if you want to control things, develop business connections to that which you wish to control. And it's a very effective way of doing that. I would note that marketing Arnold as the American Dream and Camelot's Future is very much like an updated pop marketing of the Adolf Hitler as Everyman, the embodiment of the folk who rises from nothing through strength of will to stand up on top of the mountain, very much like the Sports Illustrated picture from 12/7/87 with Schwarzenegger giving the Nazi salute, standing on top of the mountain peak. Indeed, the iconography of that picture is very much like strong elements of Nazi culture. There's a very tangible homoerotic aspect to aspects of Nazi culture, a preoccupation with the male physiology. And indeed, the iconography from that picture from Sports Illustrated is almost identical to what one sees in The Triumph of the Will. Hence the title of this broadcast, The Triumph of the Shill. There are a few things, to my mind, more cynical than marketing Schwarzenegger as Camelot's future. Yes, he's married to a member of the Kennedy clan, albeit one tied to Opus Dei. But I've never seen Maria Shriver or Sergeant Shriver, for that matter, her Opus Dei-linked father, discuss the murders of Arnold Schwarzenegger's two uncles-in-law. And indeed, George Bush, the elder, was a very close friend of George de Morenshield, a former Nazi spy, white Russian oil, the son of a white Russian oil baron, and one of Lee Harvey Oswald's intelligence babysitters. The elder George Bush, also quite close to the ABN-related milieu that was involved in killing President Kennedy. Also noting in passing as well, the tabloids are a powerful element of the opinion-forming media. I would note that the National Enquirer, the best known of those, was founded by a guy named Generoso Pope. And Generoso Pope is a former CIA psychological warfare officer. So that's something to note in passing. Again, in terms of controlling the opinion-forming media, in addition to the business connections between Joe Weider, Arnold Schwarzenegger's primary muscle entrepreneur, so to speak, the muscle of Arnold Schwarzenegger, I want to note the behavior of Schwarzenegger vis-a-vis the media coverage that stemmed from his from the publishing of the book Arnold, the Unauthorized Biography. We talked about Arnold Schwarzenegger's attempts at minimizing the damage to his image that came from the publication of this book in 1990. We're going to turn to Arnold, the Unauthorized Biography by Wendy Lee, published in hardcover by Congdon and Weed. And in the epilogue, we're going to take a look at Schwarzenegger's behavior vis-a-vis this book and his attempts at controlling public opinion. Again, these are not the actions of a mature political figure. In Arnold, the Unauthorized Biography, The Rick here is Rick Wayne, one of Arnold's former associates in the bodybuilding world, also an African-American and someone who has come forward along with a lot of other African-American or black bodybuilders, some of them African-American, some of them from Brazil. Basically, said that Schwarzenegger is a stone racist and has given a fair amount of indication of that in the past. That, too, is getting its spin, just like his admiration for Hitler, but we'll talk about that later in the program. Turning to Arnold, the unauthorized biography, taking Rick's experience into account, as well as the remarks of journalist Joan Goodman, who in Playboy characterized Arnold as, quote, one of the more finely tuned control freaks I have met in a career of celebrity journalism, unquote, I decided not to contact Arnold until my research for the book was well underway. I made no secret of the project, however, contacting Arnold's friends and family at an early age. When any of them asked me if Arnold had authorized the book, I told them he had not and that I hadn't yet contacted him but planned to when I was ready. As a result, Arnold was aware of the book from the start. His associates, Art Zeller, Frank Zane, and Joe Weider, confided to me during taped interviews that they had asked Arnold's permission to talk to me and that he had agreed to let them. Weider, however, had a court reporter present during our interview, and beforehand he insisted that I see him alone, without Steve, parenthetically her husband, who was with me, and went on to interrogate me about what I intended to write in my book. I explained that the content of my book depended on the outcome of my research. Weider left me with the distinct impression that his questions had been dictated by Arnold. After allowing Steve back into the room, he then proceeded to give me a half-hour interview, during which he was polite but didn't go into great detail. A few days afterward, I interviewed a leading bodybuilder who confided to me that Arnold had asked him to, quote, get her over to your house and tape record her without her knowing it, unquote. Confident that I was armed with enough facts to interview him in depth, I wrote to Arnold in the summer of 1989 to request an interview. His secretary, Lynn Marks, wrote back with a request for more details about my project. This response was couched in terms designed to give the impression that Arnold knew nothing about the book. Judging from what the people I interviewed had said, however, that was not true. I replied to the letter giving the requested details. However, Arnold would grant me an interview only under circumstances that would give him control of the book, and that no responsible journalist would agree to. After that, the next Arnold intimate whom I contacted and who asked Arnold's permission to talk to me, Charles Gaines, told me that Arnold's secretary had told him that Arnold, quote, very strongly discouraged him from speaking to me, unquote. I also wrote to Maria Shriver requesting an interview and received a request for more details from a representative of hers and then responded with the relevant details, but I never received a reply to my second letter. Aurelia Schwarzenegger, that's Schwarzenegger's mother, Diane Bennett, Franco Colombo, and Brigitte Nielsen ignored my written request for interviews. Franco had previously agreed to talk to me in Los Angeles, but then stood me up for lunch. Alfred Busick said he didn't have time to talk to me. Mr. C of the Salt Joke refused to talk, though he didn't deny my story. Again, the note here, the desire by Schwarzenegger to control the coverage of him. The best way to control what the media say, and you cannot do that past a point, is to behave with integrity and honorably. It's not to say anybody likes bad publicity, but basically if you're in the public eye, you are going to get publicity, and X number of people will report what you have to say honestly, and X number of them won't. I want to note here that Wendy Lee notes, a few days afterward, I interviewed a leading bodybuilder who confided to me that Arnold had asked him to, quote, get her over to your house and tape record her without her knowing it, unquote. That's a crime in many states. Illegally taping somebody or taping somebody without their knowledge is a crime, at least in many places. That may vary in some states, but in many it is actually, that's a felony. More about the coverage of Wendy Lee's Arnold, the unauthorized biography. This is from the San Jose Mercury News of Sunday, October 5th of the year 2003. This is an article by Don Nissenbaum and Eric Nalder, and it's called Taking Charge, subtitled Schwarzenegger Campaign Tightly Controlled. Now, in For the Record program number 422, we took a look at Arnold Schwarzenegger's attempts at minimizing the damage from the Wendy Lee biography. including the fact that at the Cannes Film Festival in 1990, any reporters who wanted to interview Arnold had to sign an agreement not to ask him any questions about the book. In the context of that, we read the following, skipping down. But according to Lee, the intimidation went further than Cannes. Book promotion appearances were mysteriously canceled, callers made late-night threats, and her publishers received an offer that Schwarzenegger would sell them a book if they didn't publish Lee's biography, she said. Quote, "This is a man who has total contempt for the public and the truth and does his best to suppress publicity," unquote, said Lee. And I would note that that is indeed a characteristic that seems to characterize Schwarzenegger. Does not bode well for the future, not for California and not for the rest of the country as well. Shortly before the campaign, one of the things that the mainstream media were dissed about by talk show callers was their coverage not only of Schwarzenegger's alleged sexual improprieties, but also of his well-documented expressions of admiration for Adolf Hitler. These have been heavily spun by Schwarzenegger associates. They have been characterized as in being placed in the context of admiring a lot of people, including Kennedy. I think that not only is Schwarzenegger himself a very shrewd manipulator of public opinion, he's an actor, yes, but he really is more of a politician in terms of his long contemplated ascension to public office. In 422, again, the description for 422 is longer than the program, but in 422 I discussed Schwarzenegger's Machiavellian character. If he's going to stick it to you, he is a very deliberate, far-sighted, and cynical individual. He is not stupid by any means. He's very, very cunning indeed, very far-sighted, very manipulative, and very Machiavellian. And if he's going to stick it to you, he will set you up in advance and then stick it to you, as he has many of his bodybuilding associates. As we will touch on in a few minutes, his post-Arnold, post-Wendy Lee unauthorized biography, cozying up to the Museum of Tolerance and Holocaust Remembrance, should be viewed in that context. New York Times, Friday, October 3rd of 2003, Adam Nagourney and David D. Kirkpatrick wrote the following article headlined, "Schwarzenegger Admired Hitler, Book Proposal Says." A film producer who chronicled Arnold Schwarzenegger's rise to fame as a champion bodybuilder in the 1970s circulated a book proposal 6 years ago that quoted the young Mr. Schwarzenegger expressing admiration for Adolf Hitler. The book proposal by the producer George Butler included what were presented as verbatim excerpts from interviews conducted with Mr. Schwarzenegger in the filming of the documentary Pumping Iron, unquote. In a part of the interview not used in the film, Mr. Schwarzenegger was asked to name his heroes. "Who do you admire most?" unquote. "It depends for what," Mr. Schwarzenegger said, according to the transcript contained in the book proposal. "I admired Hitler, for instance, because he came from being a little man with almost no formal education up to power. And I admire him for being such a good public speaker and for what he did with it," unquote. But in addition to the transcript, Mr. Butler wrote in his book proposal that in the 1970s he considered Mr. Schwarzenegger a flagrant, outspoken admirer of Hitler, unquote. In the proposal, Mr. Butler also said he had witnessed Mr. Schwarzenegger playing Nazi marching songs from long-playing records in his collection at home, unquote, and said that the actor frequently clicked his heels and pretended to be an SS officer, unquote. Skipping ahead in the article, a copy of the proposal for the book, which would have been entitled The Master Plan, was provided to the New York Times on Tuesday by someone who has no obvious affiliation with any of the California campaigns. The person provided the copy on the condition that his identity be kept secret and would not explain the motivation for releasing it. But the person was aware that the disclosure, coming within days of the California recall election, could damage Mr. Schwarzenegger's campaign. And again, note that George Butler, not an opponent of Arnold Schwarzenegger, said that in the 1970s, he considered Mr. Schwarzenegger, quote, a flagrant, outspoken admirer of Hitler. unquote. Now, again, this has been heavily spun by those defending Schwarzenegger, including a number of accounts that I consider to be not even, frankly, credible, that he supposedly was long ago breaking up neo-Nazi rallies, etc. I have a great deal of skepticism about that. What James Joyce referred to as the ineluctable modality of the visible should once again be viewed in Sports Illustrated, December 7th, 1987, page 84. The article Pecs Sell Ticks, authored by Dan Gehringer. That picture is reproduced on the Spitfire website, but I would encourage listeners to go to a library, get copies of the entire article, and distribute that. In particular, distribute them to media people. If Schwarzenegger had been drunk on his expletive deleted at 1 o'clock in the morning at a party, that would be one thing. But that was a very deliberate action, and I think we can safely assume that Schwarzenegger didn't decide to go for a spontaneous barefoot romp through the mountains with a photographer clad only in a tank suit and mineral oil. It's a very, very deliberate action, and with the other things that Schwarzenegger has credibly been reported as doing, it raises some very interesting questions. George Butler has said that these were the actions of a very immature man. I don't doubt that. As a good friend of mine noted, what's changed, unquote? He doesn't appear to have done a whole lot of growing up. And beyond that, I would note that there are too many indications that Schwarzenegger's inclinations in that regard are not things of the past. The most salient is his activity on behalf of Kurt Waldheim, a documented Nazi war criminal. Schwarzenegger not only invited him to his wedding, but he also has steadfastly defended Kurt Waldheim to the extent of going to Austria and helping to campaign for him and lending his image to support Waldheim's campaign. He has never recounted that. These are not the actions of a young, immature bodybuilder. These are the very deliberate, long-term international political actions of a major public figure. And that is not to be overlooked under the circumstances. Consider also the following. This from the LA Times of Saturday, August 30th of 2003. Schwarzenegger criticized for U.S. English connection. This concerns his membership on the board of directors of an organization called U.S. English. A number of estimable people had at one time or another signed on as advocates for this organization, but when some of its policies, rhetoric, and associations became clear, they took off. Not Arnold Schwarzenegger. Article by Greg Krikorian and Joe Matthews reads in part, Arnold Schwarzenegger is coming under growing criticism from civil rights groups and immigrants advocates for his 16-year membership on the advisory board of U.S. English, a Washington-based organization that bills itself as the nation's largest group dedicated to preserving English as America's official language. For much of Schwarzenegger's tenure on the board, U.S. English Incorporated has been dogged by accusations that the group's day-to-day leadership has used its English-first message to hide a more racially divisive agenda. Seizing on evidence of the group's ties to extremist groups, the country's oldest Hispanic civil rights group, the League of United Latin American Citizens, called on Schwarzenegger Thursday to quit the U.S. English board. Skipping down. Earlier this month, Mujica, that is the founder of, that is the current head of this particular organization, Mujica accepted the resignation of his communications director, James Lubinskas, after the Southern Poverty Law Center linked Lubinskas with white extremists. Mark Potok, editor of the Southern Poverty Law Center's quarterly intelligence report, said Lubinskas shared the podium at Washington, D.C. conferences in 1999 and 2000 with former Ku Klux Klan members David Duke and Don Black. In addition, Potok said Lubinskas wrote as recently as this spring for a journal run by white supremacist Jared Taylor. Lubinskas declined to comment. U.S. English is part of a much broader movement that is at its root xenophobic, exclusionary, and divisive, said Rick Schwartz, who founded the advocacy group National Immigration Forum in 1982. Again quoting, and any candidate for office who over time has been a part of such a movement, I think, deserves deep scrutiny. Consider the possibilities for the future, too. The New Yorker has an article in its September 29, 2003 article by Henrik Hertzberg. It's titled Strongman. Skipping down. On October 8, 1993, a day short of exactly 10 years before the originally scheduled date of California's recall election, one of Sylvester Stallone's better movies opened wide at area theaters. In Demolition Man, Stallone played a Los Angeles cop cryogenically frozen around the turn of the century as punishment for a bum rap, who is thawed out in the year 2032 to give chase to his similarly thawed-out criminal nemesis. He teams up with Sandra Bullock, a new-style nicey-nice police officer. She is showing him around the L.A. of the future where everything is tidy, corporate, and bland. He does a double take when she mentions the Schwarzenegger Presidential Library, unquote. Decades before, Bullock explains perkily, Arnold Schwarzenegger became so popular that the American people waived the technicalities and made him their maximum leader. In For the Record 421, I spoke about the fact that Orrin Hatch, a buddy of Arnold Schwarzenegger's, has introduced a bill to implement a constitutional amendment that would permit Schwarzenegger to run for president. Note here, his amendment stands a good chance of going to the states, 38 of which would be needed for ratification. It would certainly pass in the states where Latino and other foreign-born citizens, now 12 million strong, are concentrated, and legislators elsewhere might support it as a gesture toward the nation of immigrants, unquote, catechism of America's civil religion. One of the things to note here, skipping up at this point, Hatch is chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee where constitutional amendments originate. Note again that one of the things that's helped to shield Schwarzenegger from some of the Nazi accusations, his post-Arnold, the unauthorized biography advocacy of Holocaust tolerance, I would note, and this is noted in the description for 422, that there are links between not only the Israeli right wing, but also between the Borman Organization and the funding of Israel, not to be misunderstood as some of the Yaakiite rhetoric coming out of the progressive sector these days about Israel being a fascist country. That's not the truth. But rather along the old lines of protection money, there are links between some of the Holocaust remembrance elements and the Borman Group and the Odessa, as discussed in past programs. Again, I would characterize the recall election as basically a fascist phenomenon, in which an abused everyman has identified with somebody that really has nothing in common with them. Voter anger over things which the voters themselves have to help to implement were responsible for this. And let's conclude by going back to the book They Thought They Were Free by Milton Mayer, The Germans 1933 to 1945, and a German university professor's observations about the rise of Hitler. What happened here was the gradual habituation of the people, little by little, to being governed by surprise, to receiving decisions deliberated in secret, to believing that the situation was so complicated that the government had to act on information which the people could not understand, or so dangerous that even if the people could understand it, it could not be released because of national security. And their sense of identification with Hitler, their trust in him, made it easier to widen this gap and reassured those who would otherwise have worried about it. Long annotated descriptions of the For the Record programs in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, spitfirelist.com, wfmu.org/Dave Emery, streaming real audio, the rest of the For the Record programs for download only on a longer URL, link to both that and the Spitfire website. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 429, The Triumph of the Shill, being recorded on October 13th of 2003. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.